Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela, and I'm excited to welcome again to the podcast Shannon Felder, the NACC's training director. Welcome, Shannon.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So we're excited to talk to you today because we know you have an upcoming training that a lot of attorneys are going to be interested in, and also to have you share some of the really great tips that attorneys can use going into the courtroom as soon as tomorrow. So why don't we jump right in, and let's start by just telling us a little bit about the upcoming training, and then we'll get into the tips.
Awesome. Awesome. So on October 30th, we will begin a four-part virtual training series on high-quality legal representation in cases involving infants and toddlers. Now, we also did an infants and toddlers training series last year. Last year's training series was high-quality legal representation, but it focused more so on those who directly represent infants and toddlers. And this year, we've expanded it because we just feel this is such an important topic that we want to make sure every practitioner in the courtroom really has a robust understanding of things that we need to take into consideration. The statistics show us that children 5 and under make up half of the removals. And I saw one statistic that said every 7 minutes, an infant or toddler is removed from their home and placed in foster care somewhere in the United States. So,
wow.
Yeah. So everyone who's involved in the decision for removal, everyone who is involved in the court cases where these decisions are evaluated and plans are made for our infants and toddlers needs to be on the same page, right? We all need to have really firm understanding. And so that's why we're doing this year.
Oh, that's great. Well, I know that for the practitioners who've been there a long time, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, infants and toddlers and the research, but the research is always changing. And I think it's really important that we don't get complacent in thinking that we know because we learned attachment theory 20 years ago. You know, it really does change and evolve. And so regardless, I think, of experience level, the impacts on these young children are significant. And so I am personally excited that you guys are taking this on again. I know you had mentioned that you're doing 4 sessions. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more and give us a sneak peek, some things that attorneys could start doing now as they get ready to attend the training.
Absolutely. So the first session that we're doing is focusing on compassionate advocacy in infant and toddler cases. There are so many myths and stereotypes that surround representation of infant and toddlers or in infant and toddler cases. And so we really want to be culturally humble, and we want to talk about some of those myths and some of those stereotypes that exist and make sure that we are engaging cultural humility in our practice, but then also that we're engaging self-compassion. Of course, before I came to NACC, I was a supervising attorney for the Child Welfare Agency in my home state. And I supervised about 25 to 30 attorneys. And I can remember repeatedly being approached by one of my attorneys who just really was struggling with self-care whenever we had a case involving an infant toddler. And so we really want to dig a little bit into what does self-care and self-compassion look like in this context. If I were to give a quick tip or takeaway, I really think that in this line of work, you have to plan upon you realizing that you're suffering when it comes to your well-being. You just have to have some things that you routinely do to take care of yourself. I'll never forget I had an attorney who had young children, and she had some pretty significant physical abuse cases on her caseload involving young children. And she came into my office one day and she said, "I see the children I represent when I go home and hold my children." And, you know, first, I really appreciate the fact that she felt comfortable coming to me and us having that conversation. But I also think it's because we established a culture where that was acceptable. And there were known processes and protocols to take care of you, because we bring ourselves to all the work that we do. And so really talking about what compassionate advocacy looks like in infant and toddler cases, as it relates to the infants and toddlers, the families, and to us as individuals, is so important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. We're just coming off a series where we were really talking about both keeping lawyers in the profession and then, if for solo practitioners, keeping yourself in the profession. And I think that lawyers in particular, I know, you know, from my own experience and having a lot of colleagues who are lawyers, we tend to think of those things as extras, bonus, you know, that would be really nice if I could do those things. But what we're finding in talking to more and more people is that it is an absolute necessity in order to both stay in the profession long term, but also to properly serve your clients and to be able to go into court and advocate effectively. You have to be able to figure out, how do you compartmentalize? That's a term. It's kind of an interesting term. It sounds almost cold, but it's not what we mean. It means being able to kind of separate who you are in order to do your job and, you know, be a parent or whatever other roles that you have in your life. So in any event, I'm glad to hear you're touching on this again, because I think it takes lawyers a particularly long time to prioritize things like self-care in their day-to-day. And so I'm glad to hear that you'll be touching on that again.
Definitely, definitely. And then also, we're going to be, like I said, myth busting. And we're really excited because we're focusing in this session a little bit on the impact on family relationships whenever there is an infant and toddler case. And I think sometimes as practitioners in the field, you know, especially if you have a newborn, you really don't, you know, think of, you know, them having had a chance to bond or attach to their birth family. And not just looking at the parents, but looking at those extended family relationships and how the infant and toddler is impacted when those relationships are not fully developed. And not just looking at it at the moment of removal or foster care involvement, but over the course of that child's life relationship with the parent and how all of that is impacted. I think one of the goals that we have from this training series is for us to have evidence-based information and proper perspectives when we make decisions as advocates. And the first step in that is getting rid of some of the assumptions and stereotypes that we may just have surrounding these cases.
Absolutely. Do you think because I know exactly what you're talking about, you know, siblings are something, sibling visitation, sibling placements, these are all things that people talk about a lot. And everyone says, yes, we should place siblings together. But then you get placed in these situations that are more nuanced and people really do struggle. I think we also know sometimes that first placement decision sticks. Like, we think we'll go back and fix it. And then the next case comes and the next case comes and suddenly months have passed. I wonder whether you're getting into any specific strategies about keeping siblings together and keeping those family relationships intact during the system involvement.
And we are definitely exploring that throughout the course of this series. You know, when we talk about placement decisions, a lot of times, you know, we see situations where if there are older siblings, they may be placed together, but then that infant or toddler, the same priority is not put on that infant and toddler being in the home with the other siblings. And so, you know, we hear things at court like, well, you know, these siblings, they have a relationship with one another and all of these other things, and they don't give it the same weight when it comes to that younger child, especially, like I said, that newborn. And so we really want to explore the significance and importance of maintaining sibling connection, as well as connection to extended family for infants and toddlers. So we're really excited to delve into that.
That's a great, I think that is a great topic, and people will appreciate learning more about that, because we've all heard that, you know, there's the breaking of the bond, but there's also the loss of it going forward. And I think that's what gets lost. So yes. Something people are going to be thinking about again tomorrow is not discounting it just because it hasn't formed yet doesn't mean there's no loss.
Yes. And understanding that, you know, as you said, science is evolving and we're learning more each and every day about how significant it is to allow those bonds to form. And, you know, when we talk about ambiguous loss, when we talk about relational losses, understanding that that exists for the infant and toddler as well, even if it's not articulated at the time or even fully realized at the time, when these infants and toddlers become older, when we hear their voices, they're experiencing that same type of loss, whether it's the birth parents, the siblings, extended family, and culture. We'll also be delving into that, that loss of culture.
Yes, absolutely. Well, can you tell us about any of the other sessions that are coming up in the training?
Sure. So we're also going to be dealing with understanding the harm in infant and toddler cases. We're going to be joined by a pediatrician that's going to help us really talk about understanding how to appropriately look at the evidence in cases of physical abuse, in cases of suspected sexual abuse, poverty versus neglect. We're going to be talking a lot about cases where there's substance use in the home and understanding how that impacts infants and toddlers. I think sometimes in making decisions in cases, especially involving younger children, we hear phrases like we're going to err on the side of caution. And a lot of times what that really means is we don't have a full understanding of how these younger children are actually impacted by certain things. And so we want to do as much as possible to provide some evidence-based information on understanding what the harms are to children in these scenarios. We're also going to be digging a little bit into how domestic violence in the home affects infants and toddlers. And all of that foundation is going into a session that we're going to do solely on advocacy around the removal decision. We know, again, that infants and toddlers are removed at a higher rate than other age groups. And understanding the things that we need to put into consideration when we're making that removal decision is going to be such a game changer, right? Just really being able to talk about the trauma of removal to the infant and toddler. You know, a lot of times when we have this discussion, we look at the trauma of removal and we talk about how that impacts older children, where relationships, again, as you mentioned, are already established. We don't look at the trauma, and there's evidence that talks about the trauma, even in these younger children, even a newborn, you know, has trauma of removal. There was a study that we'll most likely reference in the training that actually showed that in cases where there was a discovery of substance use prenatally, that some of the symptoms that were attributed to withdrawal were actually not withdrawals from the substance. It was the fact that the hospitals routinely separated the mom from the baby because of the substance use, and the baby was not withdrawing from the substance. They were missing that skin-to-skin contact, that opportunity to be with that mom. And so even the decision to not allow contact in a hospital whenever there are certain psychologies, is actually traumatic to that infant child.
And I think that, you know, that again goes to, as lawyers, we have to stay on top of the research and not rest on our former trainings and our, you know, we develop beliefs through these trainings, but the system changes and we learn new things. And as you were talking, one of the things that came up for me was I had watched the documentary called Take Care of Maya. I don't know if you saw that one, but, you know, it's obviously a tragic case. And I would encourage people to watch that, you know, if you're. But what the takeaway was, I think, in that instance was over-reliance on an individual doctor to make, you know, lifelong decisions in these cases. And I think that, of course, we should rely on experts. Of course, we should bring in folks that understand, you know, doctors that understand things at a deeper level than we ever can as a lawyer. And we need to be equipped to ask further questions and not just say, okay, the doctor says, because, and that to me was the thing about the case is that we tend to in systems says they can't go home. That's that, you know, and I think that that is part of how we end up in these cycles of removals and we can't shift things because we as lawyers don't have the confidence to question some of the things that have always been done. And so it sounds to me like this pediatrician that's coming on your training might equip lawyers to really at least ask good questions. Ultimately, the judge decides. But if all we do is take at face value the first recommendation and don't take our new research and ask, are they aware and do those types of things, then we are not serving our clients in the way that we could.
Definitely. And that is part of what we're going to be exploring, like understanding what it means to evaluate the pediatrician's opinion and to look at the basis for the pediatrician's opinion. And beyond that, to look at the appropriate parameters, right? So even if you have someone that can say these particular injuries are non-accidental and are indicative of abuse, that doesn't translate to that pediatrician being able to make decisions on placement, visitation, right? So really understanding the parameters of that. And then also, you talked about taking care of Maya. One of the things that also came from that is knowing that we need to look at how the child abuse pediatrician engaged with the family. Did they interview the family? Did the family understand at the time of that interview that this was not a member of the medical team solely for the purpose of rendering care to the child, but also was a part of the investigative team that was going to be a part of making a decision as to whether abuse or neglect occurred? And so along with the pediatrician, we're going to be exploring the ethics that apply to a pediatrician doing these types of investigations and what we as practitioners need to know so that we can incorporate those ethics requirements into our direct and cross-examination.
What we're talking about takes a lot of courage on behalf of a lawyer. And I think that a lot of the reason that people don't do this is because they don't have the confidence. And so I think it's a reason to come and really do an in-depth, you know, a deep dive into understanding, like you said, the parameters. What does it actually mean? What are they not equipped to testify to? Let's not take the easy route and just let someone who's qualified to say one thing dictate the direction of the case. That is where our expertise and our critical thinking comes in. And I have to acknowledge that this is what we're asking is difficult and will be a change for a lot of people, but can be very significant to your client and worth the time to really educate yourself and be able to take on those tough cross-examinations.
Definitely. I also think that it helps us to engage with our client in a more relevant way. It helps us know what questions we need to ask our clients as we prepare them. It helps us to know what their experience may have been, whether we're representing parents or the child or the agency, understanding the dynamics and the interplay between the medical professionals that assist in decision-making and our clients is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it already sounds like a very exciting training. Is there anything else you want to share with our audience?
Sure. So, of course, we're going to wrap the series up by taking all of those pieces of information, right? So we've really been laser focused on understanding the things that we need to consider, especially before removal. But then we know that removal is necessary in some instances. And so we're going to wrap up really talking about collaborative advocacy and in toddler cases, really digging into case plan advocacy, placement advocacy, family time, and well-being advocacy. And again, doing this through a collaborative lens. So really kind of wrapping up with, okay, we have all the information. Now let's work together to make sure that we're serving our infants and toddlers who are systems involved well. So yeah, we're really excited about the scope of the training. Now I also think I should let everyone know last year's training was so phenomenal, right? And really delved into a lot of child development. It really examined the evidence as it relates to stages of development, like you said, in depth and attachment, talked about the impact of trauma and maltreatment on development. And also talked about how to assess developmental delays. You know, a lot of times there's a question of was the developmental delay caused by the trauma or, you know, did it exist? It's hard to determine that with infants and toddlers. And so some time was spent last year dealing with that. And the reason that I keep referencing last year's training is because we made the decision at NACC that some of that information from last year was so foundational and so fundamental that if someone did not attend last year's series, they might want to take that deep dive into those areas. And so we made the decision that when you register for this year's infants and toddlers training, for a limited time, you get access to all the recordings of last year's training. So you're getting 4 sessions this year, but you're getting access to the 3 sessions from last year as well.
So it's really 2-for-1. You're getting access to last year's and this year's, which I think wonderful for practitioners. I did want to just piggyback off one more thing before you wrapped up. And I am delighted to hear that you are going to talk about case plan advocacy. I think that's one of those things that at conferences and at the national level, we talk about a lot. But I will tell you that in my consulting work on the ground, I don't see it. What I hear a lot is case plans aren't being sent out. They're not even being really reviewed by anyone. They're just being brought before the judge. They're cookie cutter. They are not tailored to the family. And this is, I mean, talk about a key role for an attorney for a child. I mean, this is the document that guides the case. And the fact that so many systems are not using that case plan as a way to really set a family up for success is tragic. And so I am glad to hear that that's something that you're going to be talking about, because I think many lawyers don't see that they're really able to influence that, and they absolutely are.
And that is so essential, right? When we look at the data, we know that the average time in care once a child is removed is 22.5 months. And if you think about, you know, the children in your family, the difference in infancy in 22.5 months is incredible. It's daunting. That's probably the word that I should use. And so when we think about case plan advocacy, we want to make sure that the case plan is tailored to reunify the family. It shouldn't have anything extra in it that creates a hurdle or a potential delay in reunification. And so, yeah, case plan advocacy is so important. And understanding that this is the opportunity for us to really craft something to meet the family's needs and set the family up for success long after all of us are involved. And so, yeah, it's such a significant part of what we do. like you said, it's where everyone should really show their strongest advocacy skills and really make sure that there are no cookie cutter unnecessary services, but again, it's tailored to the needs of the family.
Absolutely. So we'll leave our audience with that takeaway. If you are not currently actively working in the development of the case plan, asking for tests to be taken out that are not relevant to the family, you can start that tomorrow. If you're not getting them, start the process of getting them sent to you according to your statute. These are things that can really, really impact the direction of the case. We are excited about this training and we encourage everybody to sign up. We will have the links in the show notes and we look forward to learning along with you. So thank you so much, Shannon.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks everybody for listening. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.